Good evening. My name is Katie Stewart, and I'm a student project supervisor at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, I would like to welcome you to tonight's lecture, Real Reform, Real Leadership. In the face of a heated debate on healthcare reform, President Obama stresses the need to fix a broken and inefficient system. With widespread public interest in this debate, town halls are overflowing like never before, with citizens concerned about how reform would impact their lives. As Congress returns from its summer recess to formulate legislation for the reform of the U.S. healthcare system, the American people are trying to get a grasp on the true details of the proposals and see a clear picture of the way forward to an affordable, efficient, and quality system of healthcare. Dr. David Nash was the founding dean of the Jefferson School of Population Health. In 1990, he founded the Office of Health Policy with the goal of producing a new kind of healthcare leader. Dr. Nash has written extensively on healthcare and management, his publications appearing in over 100 major journal articles, in addition to the 19 books which he has edited. In recognition of his accomplishment, Dr. Nash has received the Lashley Prize from the Academy of Managed Care and Pharmacy in 1995, the 1997 Philadelphia Business Journal Healthcare Heroes Award, and the 2006 Elliott Stone Award for Leadership and Public Accountability and Data. The journal Modern Healthcare has repeatedly identified Dr. Nash as one of the top 100 persons in healthcare. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, since this program is being taped and some of our audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait for a microphone to reach you before speaking during the question and answer session at the end of the program. In addition, please feel free to stop by the table in the lobby to view a selection of Dr. Nash's books. Thank you, and please join me in welcoming Dr. David Nash.
Good evening. Thank you very much, Katie. You did a wonderful job. I think you have a future in this kind of work. And thank you so much for the invitation. We were looking forward to this evening nearly 10 months ago, and I have a lot of people to thank who helped make tonight possible. Before I do that, to the students, I feel your pain. I'm the father of 22-year-old twin daughters who both just, thank goodness, graduated from college, and they're both off the payroll. That deserves a round of applause. And my youngest is a freshman at GW in Washington. I told the folks at dinner we hadn't heard from him in 8 days. He resurfaced last night, so we know he's there. Whether he's done anything except go to orientation or not, we're not sure. So he'll quickly learn how difficult the road really is. But I appreciate coming out on a weeknight just in the beginning of school, and I know how busy everybody is, so I'm very, very appreciative. There are many people that I do want to thank for tonight. I'm especially pleased that Provost Weissman could come. I know he's got a lot on his plate. And Professor David Sarcone and Professor Harry Pullman, Jolie Rankin, and all the people, students, and others involved in the Clark Forum. It's really a fantastic program. I also want to thank my colleague, Dr. Ed Fliegler, who was responsible for introducing me to the Dickinson family, and I'm most appreciative of his kindness expressed that way. We brought some faculty members from our new school. I want to take a moment to recognize them, the Associate Dean Caroline Golob and Associate Professor Vittorio Maio. Let me just say for one moment, Associate Professor Vittorio Maio is married to one of your professors by the same last name. This is a harbinger of our future relationship between Dickinson and Jefferson. And finally, in the audience are two people who deserve special recognition, and that is, if you look up here, you'll see Dr. Raymond C. and Doris N. Grandin, and Dr. and Mrs. Grandin are in the audience. I'd like to ask them to stand for a moment and accept a round of applause and recognition. Would you please? Doris and Ray, nearly a decade ago, underwrote and endowed the fifth chair in health policy in the United States, the first of its kind at Jefferson. And we're incredibly grateful for their ongoing support and generosity. And I've gotten to know them over a very long period of time. It's been a wonderful relationship, and I'm so glad that they're able to be here tonight. So the Clark Forum, wow, I learned a lot in the last 10 months from Professor Sarcone and others. The theme about leadership, modern culture, the bridge between the classroom and the real world. So I'm very happy to be a part of this, and I understand tonight is one of the sort of inaugural leadership components of the Clark Forum, so I'm especially honored to kick off this program in that way. I want to thank President Obama for the speech last night, a very good prelude to today. It just so happened, ladies and gentlemen, yesterday, 9/9/09, was the first day of school for the Jefferson School of Population Health. 2 years of work culminating in yesterday. And I made a quick call to the White House and I said, if the president could give a speech on opening day for us, we would be grateful. And he accommodated us, and it was wonderful. And so I'm awfully happy that that worked out. So our time together this evening, we have a heterogeneous audience. This is not a group of busy physicians, nurses, and pharmacists. These are concerned citizens, and we're here under the auspices of a leadership forum. So here's what I'd like to do to tackle the topic at hand. I think there's three things we ought to try to cover, and I'm going to be very cognizant of your time. Part one, let me give you some vocabulary and a quick run-through. Try to answer the question, why is leadership and health reform, where's the disconnect? What are the challenges that we're facing? So part one, what are the challenges? Part two, I'd like to try to answer the question and have your help in figuring out, is population health part of the answer to health reform? So part one, what are the challenges? Part two, how does population health figure into the answer? And then part three, if we have time, I'd like to give you a brazen advertisement for the Jefferson School of Population Health. And that's my goal for this evening. You have, I believe, the slides in front of you, which is wonderful, and I want to thank everybody for making the handouts. This is a cartoon, if you would, a drawing of the downtown campus of Jefferson University. I was telling our dinner guests, calling Thomas Jefferson University the university is really not the same as a Big Ten school. We don't have an undergraduate school like Dickinson. We don't have a law school or a business school. Jefferson is a full-services health sciences university, and that's jargon for medical school, nursing school, pharmacy school, allied health school, and now, as of yesterday, the Jefferson School of Population Health. So that's what we're all about, and this is a drawing of the now existing beautiful downtown Hamilton building on our campus, right in Center City, Philadelphia. And if we have time, we'll come back and I'll give you a little bit of a geography. So to get into part one, and again, beautiful timing with regard to the president's presentation last night, I couldn't help but show you this is not an internet doctored slide made by my 18-year-old. This is a true cover of The Economist just this past summer. This is going to hurt, and you know, great picture there, the way they superimposed his face. And I think that last night we could spend a lot of time on what did he say, what did he not say, what's the politics. Maybe we'll do that during the question and answers. But I just wanted to give you a sense of what the rest of the world, in the via The Economist, is thinking and what kinds of things they're showing about the healthcare challenge in our country. So for sure, reforming healthcare, that is really going to hurt. Now, this is also from The Economist. It's a little difficult maybe to see in the back. So here's a caricature of the president. He says, excuse me, can anyone tell me if this is the path to comprehensive and affordable healthcare? And look at the monsters lined up, and special interest is about to whack him, and here's a buzzsaw. And he's, you know, just waving high in his usual congenial, conciliatory, bipartisan way. And they're going to chop his head off just as soon as he walks down this path. And then there's a bear trap in case they miss that. So this is just for fun. It doesn't have much to do with the topic at hand. I promised this would not be a clinical talk, but I have to show you just two x-rays, so you'll bear with me for a moment. I won't call on any of the pre-med students who I met this afternoon to read the film, but let me show you what this is about. So it's a little washed out and given the lighting, but I'm sure most of you can sort of tell this is the hip bone, the leg bone, the spinal cord here, and this is a side view, and this is what we call an anterior posterior view right through the belly button. And you'll note that this poor person has some stuff here on your left, and a lot of stuff here that's lighting up, and they look kind of like big screws, and they are. This is an x-ray of somebody who's had spinal fusion surgery, and there are four screws holding together L5 and S1, and there's a couple of lug nuts and some other details. But I'm happy to tell you, these are my x-rays from May 2002, a little over 7 years ago. So why am I showing you x-rays of my spinal fusion surgery from 7 years ago? There's two principal reasons. One, this elicits audience sympathy. But more importantly, it's part of a story that I'd like to weave into our time together tonight, and let me just frame up the question. So imagine that you're the Dr. Raymond C. and Doris N. Grandin Professor of Health Policy at the nation's largest private medical school. At the time, 2002, I was the chair of our Department of Health Policy inside the medical school. Details not important. But imagine you're a health policy big shot, and your back hurts like heck, really hurts, for 3 years. And your doctor tells you you're going to need surgery to fix this problem. It can't be fixed with physical therapy, training, massage, whatever. And in fact, you're going to need four screws, and it's going to take 8 hours, and you'll be out of work for 10 weeks. And when you go back to work, you'll be wearing a back brace, and you'll be using a cane. That's pretty scary stuff. But beyond scary, here's the policy question. After your orthopedist who you trust tells you you need this, where do you go to get it done? How do you get empowered, like the president said last night? How do you get the right information to make the right decision to go to the right place that's going to do it at a competitive price, give you a good outcome, so that you'll be able to live without pain? These are very important, and at the time, incredibly personal questions that I had to answer. I won't bore you with the details of how it all worked out. I will tell you, though, thank goodness I am pain-free and have been since post-operative day one. So that's a wonderful outcome. Regrettably, the vast majority of patients who have a comparable procedure to mine can't say that they've had such a good outcome. So the question on deck for us to come back to when we're all done is, what's an accountable system that gives people like you and me, because we're all going to be patients one day if you haven't been already, what kind of system will give us the information, the wherewithal, the knowledge, the transparency to be able to figure out, well, where should I go when I really need an important, complex, high-tech procedure like spinal fusion? So let's get into those issues. Well, the good news is, in our great commonwealth, we have a lot of transparency, which I think many folks don't really think about. There are even leaders in the room this evening, including folks like Leroy Erickson and others, who played a role in making our state the sort of bellwether state for giving patients information. And you can read just like I can. Now, it doesn't say spinal fusion, but this report in Pennsylvania is a symbol of where we've got to go. This report lists every orthopedist in Pennsylvania who does hip and knee surgery, and they don't all get an A. That's an important lesson. There's a bell curve in the distribution of what doctors do. Now, we better close the door, because if I talk louder, I might be in a lot of trouble for the Pennsylvania Medical Society. But there's a bell curve distribution of the outcomes of what our colleagues do, and this report is just one aspect of that transparency, that kind of accountability that we're going to need to make any kind of reform really work. And if we have time, we'll come back to that as well. So let's get a little deeper into what are the challenges we face, and you can read along with me. All integrated delivery systems and their managed care partners are accountable to the public for their degree of success. If this initiative is not taken by the medical profession, it will be taken by the lay public. Now, what's remarkable about this is, of course, this. Because I could have written here September 10th, 2009, and everyone would have said, oh, that's an interesting issue. But this comes from the incorporating documents from the American College of Surgeons at their inaugural meeting in Midtown Manhattan at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel during World War I. And so last night, when the president said, many have tried and failed. He wasn't kidding. Because the issues that we're talking about this evening, you can trace back nearly to the First World War. And look at what this talks about, public accountability, grabbing the initiative. So one aspect of the leadership we're going to need for real reform when we get to part two together is going to be to tackle the issues that have been around for 90 plus years. And every time I show this slide, I think, boy, there's not a lot new under the policy sun to some extent because of the work of our colleagues going back to World War I. So what are some of the other challenges we face? And you're never going to hear a politician talk about this because it doesn't lend itself to a 15-second meet-the-press soundbite. It's too complicated, and it's incredibly disheartening. So I hope you'll be okay after I share this with you. This is the cover of Business Week magazine. I know many of you read this. And again, not an internet-doctored cover, but a real one from just a couple of years ago. Medical guesswork. From heart surgery to prostate care, we know little about which treatment really works. How do you think something like this goes over at Jefferson Medical College? No, it's not a popular thing. So I think there's two aspects to this cover we need to think about. One is the people who pay the bills for healthcare are the readers of Business Week, because we're the only nation in the world where most healthcare coverage is linked to the site of employment. So the people who run the companies who purchase healthcare that we use read Business Week, and they're on to us as a profession. Meaning, regrettably, if you believe all of the research literature, doctors have the right information to make the right decision about healthcare about 1 out of 5 times. About 18% of the time, plus or minus 2%. That's a pretty scary thought. What about those 4 out of 5 times? What do we call that? Well, you and I know we call that the art of medicine. Now, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with the art of medicine. It's incredibly expensive. We've come to learn it's incredibly wasteful of resources, and it's now driven us to a point where healthcare is 17% of our nation's economy. So medical guesswork is a kind of scary thought that we only have the information right 1 out of 5 times, but the economic implications of that are even scarier, and that led us in part to the president's speech last night. Here's another scary thought. It might be a little hard to see in the back, but this comes from one of our most prestigious journals, the New England Journal of Medicine. In the last 2 years, a series of articles that have examined how do we do as a profession, the healthcare industry, when patients come to us with a whole series of pretty important medical problems like breast cancer, my favorite, low back pain, coronary disease, heart failure, and so on. And don't worry about the abbreviations. The main message here is uneven adherence to the evidence, which is a very, very polite way of saying we get it right 55% of the time. Now, that could be inflammatory to some individuals, for sure. It certainly is at my everyday place of work. But when you couple getting it right about half the time, even when we have an idea of what it is we're doing, and only having the right information available to us 1 out of 5 times, you start to get an appreciation for what makes doctors nervous every day. Making a mistake, failing to diagnose, failure to follow up, worrying about professional liability. When you grasp all of that onto our crazy hodgepodge system, you begin to get the disquieting feeling of what doctors go through on a day-to-day basis. So I guess the take-home message so far is it's a pretty complicated business. Imagine the President of the United States in a joint session of Congress explaining to the American people our amazing technologic healthcare system on a good day gets it right about half the time. That would be the last speech he ever gives. And so it doesn't lend itself to public discourse about what are the real underlying, the soft belly, if you would, of how complicated fixing this mess is going to be. Wait, there's more. So we need a definition so we can have a conversation. And one definition for equality, my favorite, comes from the Institute of Medicine in Washington. 1991, you can read along with me, the degree to which health services for individuals and populations increases the likelihood of a desired health outcome, and is consistent with current professional knowledge. So there are really three core concepts in here, and we won't have time to go over everything tonight, but there's a population word in there, very important to us in the school of population health. There's a couple of challenges. Let me hit two. So in modern medical education, and for all the pre-medical students who I had the pleasure of meeting this afternoon, and all of my colleagues back at Jefferson, you know, we currently teach one patient, one problem, one at a time. And when you're sitting on that silly tissue paper on the examining room table, wearing the very silly gown we give you, the ambient temperature is 55 degrees Fahrenheit, your IQ has dropped by 40 points just by virtue of being nervous and being in that room. Do you care that your physician has not had a population-based focus? I don't think so. You want one patient, one problem, one at a time. The nation, however, is calling for what? A population-based focus so we can allocate the resources in a more equitable manner. You understand the tension between one patient, one problem, one at a time, and the population focus, we simply can't afford to keep the status quo as it is. It's, in the president's words, untenable. So this creates tension in the world of people like us in our school who measure quality, evaluate it, think about safety, and so on. There are a couple of books out there I'm going to recommend, most especially for the students. Tonight we don't have time to talk about the details of the 1999 critically important watershed event publication of To Err Is Human, a book that showed us a decade ago that healthcare is unsafe when you're a patient. And you're all familiar with the dreadful reality that we are faced with an epidemic of medical mistakes. Are they deliberate? Certainly not. Do we commit them every day, even at our own institution? Regrettably, yes. So we have failed systems, failed processes, which this book pointed out. That complicates the problem. It leads to headlines like this. Why are so many still die needlessly in hospitals in our most important medical journal, USA Today? It also leads to headlines like this from an incredibly important report from, of all people, Consumers Union, that's right, the same people who grade televisions and refrigerators this past summer, when they said, to err is human, to delay is deadly. What they're getting at here is a decade past publication of To Err Is Human, the error rate in America's hospitals has not gone down by a single percentage point, by all the evidence we have. So that's pretty scary. Could you imagine the President of the United States saying in a joint session of Congress that we kill 150,000 hospitalized patients every year by accident? He's not going to say that, but that's what we deal with every day. Imagine trying to explain that on Meet the Press. And there's more. Two summers ago, Time magazine covered, what do doctors hate about hospitals? Well, I always have fun when I'm with a clinical audience and I ask them this question. You can imagine what they say. But I'll give you the punchline. What do doctors hate about hospitals? That's easy. Being a patient in one. And that's what this cover story is all about. Eight physician families egregiously harmed from preventable medical mistakes, leading to a cover story in Time magazine. In 2001, another important book, regrettably we don't have time for all the details, but Crossing the Quality Chasm laid out from the Institute of Medicine what the future of healthcare should look like. And let me summarize the whole book in one slide. Basically, the nation's smartest people in our business got together and worked for 2 years, 1999-2000, and then they published this book in 2001, which said, we've got to create a system that has six domains or characteristics. Let me quickly list them for you. The system should be safe. Notice they made that first. Did you hear anything last night about safety? Well, if you listened carefully, he did mention we have to reduce hospital-acquired infection. He did mention that in passing. But the Institute of Medicine puts it first as a key criteria for a system design of the future. Second criteria, it ought to be effective. meaning don't waste my time and energy. Do what's right. Do it the first time correctly. There ought to be patient-centered, timely, equitable, and efficient. And if we had more time, we could drill into detail of each of these, but I think the main message is our smartest leaders a decade ago described the system with these six key characteristics, really none of which, or maybe one, was mentioned last night. So again, it's a complicated story. What we're really talking about on the political front is health insurance reform, not health care reform. And that, I think, is a very important distinction, which we'll get to in a moment. Okay, so I think we've summarized part one. It's a lot of problems. It's incredibly complicated. We're trying our best. But since 1918, we've recognized that we don't have all the information we need. The systems we rely upon are complicated and failing. So let's get to some good news and try to tackle the answer to the question, is population health, is the Jefferson School of Population Health going to be a part of the solution to the challenges that we're facing? So suspend your political inclinations for 10 more minutes, and let's explore together the answer to the question, what kind of leadership would it take for real reform? Well, we've already hinted at a couple of things. Let's drill a little deeper into the question, what sort of leadership would it take for real reform? So we have to ask ourselves, you know, what's the question? The question is population health the answer? Where are we now? Just showed you that. And now, where are we going to go? Okay, so let's think about a couple of things. So first, when you get a professor type, I have to ask you some questions. If you know the answer, don't scream it out. Please raise your hand. So here's the question. In the United States in 2009, what percentage of adults over 18 do the following on a regular basis? Exercise 20 minutes three times a week. They don't smoke. They eat their fruits and vegetables regularly. They wear seatbelts, and they're somewhere close to their appropriate weight. This is the BMI. What percentage of Americans 2009, September, do all five things? Anybody raise your hand if you think you know the answer. Please, help me out. It's stressful being up here. You have to raise your hand. What percentage of Americans do these five things regularly? Please, yes, ma'am.
30%.
30%. We have one at 30%. Yes, ma'am.
20.
20%. We have one at 20.
Five.
We have one at five. Okay, excellent. Well, it shows the heterogeneity of our audience, doesn't it? That's fascinating. So the correct answer is, of course, drum roll, 3%. And the reference, if you're interested, is a fascinating paper from Annals of Internal Medicine in April 2006, just a few years ago. A fantastic study from the University of Michigan, a very reputable group. So 3%. What the President of the United States should have done last night is get up and say, wear a seatbelt, stop smoking, himself included, eat fruits and vegetables, do what your mother told you, wash your hands, and push away that extra dessert. Because if we could take it from 3% to 8%, 10%, we would bend the cost curve down, save trillions, and probably pay to insure the 55 million of our fellow citizens who lack insurance today. Did you hear anything like that last night?
I didn't.
Because why? Well, our culture, the president's words, rugged individualism, our culture is, let's take the cholesterol-lowering pill on the way to McDonald's. That's our culture. That's rugged individualism. You're not going to tell me what I can eat. I don't want to go before a death panel. That's how they're connected. That's the same kind of thing. Because the government can't interfere. Meanwhile, the government of the United States is the largest single purchaser of health care in the world, bar none, by a factor of 1.5. And I'm talking about Medicare. One of my favorite political stories, not from this era, but when Bill Clinton ran a second time against Bob Dole, it was a famous piece. An elderly woman breaks through a barrier when Bob Dole is speaking at the airport in Philadelphia. She's in her mid-70s, runs across the tarmac, grabs the senator and says, "Senator, Senator, get the government out of my Medicare." A depth of understanding of the issues. So that's just part, that's the first slide of where we might go and the kind of leadership necessary to fix this mess. So the true determinants of health in the United States, really, number one, smoking. Number two, our unhealthy diet, our incredible national epidemic of obesity. All you need to do is travel overseas once. And when you come back, you notice, my God, what a fat country we are. And that's true. Number three, physical inactivity, and number four, alcohol. Together, these account in the United States in 2009 for 40% of all deaths. So it's not the failing spinal fusion surgery or the failed open heart surgery or the brain surgery that we couldn't get the tumor. That's what makes headlines. Or Octomom. That's what makes headlines. The truth is 40% of this mess is due to stuff largely under our control. You didn't hear any of this, and you haven't heard any of it in the last, really, 3 months of conversation. How about that war on cancer? Let me preface this by saying Jefferson University is a major institute recognized by the National Cancer Institute of the United States. There are three such sites in Philadelphia. We spend more on cancer research on a per capita basis than any nation in the world, by a large margin. Most of the gains in cancer survival in the last 30 years are due to declines in smoking. Now, sure, it's wonderful, God forbid you have a child with leukemia, we will save her life. And it's wonderful that we have genetic tests now for colon cancer, aspects of this research done in a building across the street from my office. That's what makes headlines. But the war on cancer is a euphemism. It's amorphous. The war on cancer really is almost entirely due to the successes of that war, or due to teaching my children in elementary school that smoking is bad. That's where the major gains have come from. So, there's even more to the story. When you think about reforming healthcare versus reforming health, I mean, these are complex social issues which we can't resolve very quickly, especially given our national character of rugged individualism, doing our own thing without interference from big government. The issues really are that we spend under 2% of all health dollars on population health, and chronic diseases, heart failure, diabetes, chronic obstructive lung disease, comprise 80% of the total disease burden, and there's no dedicated federal funding stream, I don't know how to go there, no dedicated stream to this most important aspect of what we do. And in part, why is this? Well, it's sociology more than it is sort of anything having to do with medicine. Here's what I mean. Chronic diseases, with all due respect, from a medical education perspective, aren't sexy. Chronic disease, the care of patients with chronic illness, isn't what makes headlines. Medical students aren't going to trail behind me when we go to a nursing home to care for patients with chronic heart failure. They want to be in the operating room seeing a hip transplant or a microsurgical incision and heart surgery done on pump at the same time. I mean, amazing stuff, miracle every day. That's what makes headlines. But the reality is, we've got some real fundamental resource allocation questions because the money, the answer is in caring for persons with chronic illness. We'll come back to that as well. Now, in the last year, we've had an economic challenge for sure. I don't know how your 201k is doing, but mine's not doing too well. The reality is, and the president touched on this, one thing he did get right, we cannot fix healthcare without fixing the economy, and you cannot fix the economy without dealing with healthcare. They are inexorably linked, due in no small part to its 17% of the GDP for sure, but also driving the deficit, the number one driver of the largest deficit in U.S. history. Remember, Bill Clinton left us with a surplus 8 years of war, whatever your politics, the reality is President Obama inherited an incredible deficit that's only being driven at $1 billion a day in war spending, equal to the $1 billion a day in Medicare spending. It cannot go on unfettered. It cannot, it's unsustainable. And your generation, the college students in the audience tonight, you're going to be facing some very difficult issues. If the experts are right, the Medicare Trust Fund will be bankrupt in 2017. That sounded really far away a little while ago. We're talking about 7.5 years. If you're a freshman at Dickinson, let's see. So you'll take 4 more years. So right around the time you'll be in your first job, get ready, Medicare will be bankrupt. Now you won't be caring too much because you'll just be under 30, but your parents will be caring an awful lot. Because if we don't do something about this, fixing the economy and fixing healthcare. So what's the evidence about what I'm claiming here? Well, let me just give you a couple of references. You can read all this on your own. The Race Between Education and Technology by Golden and Katz. The recent Businessweek piece on big job engines. Have you seen a healthcare company get a bailout? Name one. You can't. Why? Well, healthcare is a robust, money-making, incredibly important part of what made America's economy great. If we mess with that too much, we'll be in even bigger trouble than we're in today. And then finally, The Big Fix by David Leonhardt, one of the classic articles this past week. So now we have to drill a little deeper. The president mentioned prevention. He didn't get into how few people practice it. He really didn't talk too much about personal responsibility for improving our own health, because Americans don't want to be preached to about exercise and diet. We really certainly don't want to hear that from our government leaders. That's getting inside our own kitchen, inside our own bedroom. Too scary. But the realities are, is prevention the answer? Well, the evidence is mixed. The reality is the policies about prevention should fund services that produce the greatest benefit. Whether or not it actually saves money moving forward, here's what I mean. If we were to practice prevention, stop smoking, and so on, it's conceivable in certain models that we would live so long that we would end up consuming an awful lot of medical care because, quite frankly, forgive me, when you die, that's the end of the expense. So there is a research on the prevention front that's a little confusing, and the models sometimes don't make too much sense. But clearly in the short term, the evidence, and we won't go into all these abbreviations, the evidence is unequivocal in the short term. If we could harness that 3% and make it 8%, if we could reduce medical error, if we could have better information at our fingertips to make better decisions, clinically speaking, we would bend that cost curve down and we'd probably be able to pay for the uninsured out of those savings alone. Okay, so what about that stimulus package from this past summer? You all remember now the ARRA. Well, if you read the report and if you read the legislation, there's some interesting stuff buried in there. The president called this the down payment on health reform. Remember that from really May and June, the down payment, because he was hoping by September 10th it would all be done. But the down payment on reform was really composed of a couple of things. One was a lot of money, by our standards, $400 million, into doing comparative effectiveness research. Now, could you imagine the President of the United States giving an address to the joint session of Congress, explaining to America, let me explain what we mean by comparative effectiveness research. I don't think that would have lasted more than a minute. People would have tuned out. So this is a complicated area. Comparative effectiveness research basically helps doctors, nurses, pharmacists, hospitals, and others figure out, is it worth it on the margin to buy this drug, to use this procedure? It's going to give us information to help raise all boats and help us to do a better job. But that means that we're not doing such a hot job now. Nobody really wants to go through those details, most especially in public. Number two, health information technology. We talked a little bit about this with the pre-med group earlier today. Well, $20 billion, all the people involved in information technology and healthcare are awfully excited about that. That's a lot of money compared to $400 million, for sure. Well, you know, when you go to the doctor today, here's the analogy I'd like to draw for you. It's like she's scratching on the cave wall with a piece of charcoal. You know, when my family and I, like yours, traveled, all five of us, to Dublin, Ireland 2 years ago, and I took out my PNC bank card and stuck it in the bank machine in downtown Dublin, and it knew who I was, knew my balance, translated dollars to euros, charged me a hefty percentage fee, and out came the money we needed for dinner. And when you go to your doctor, generally speaking, in the vast majority of interactions, including at our own leading medical school, tell me your name again. Can I have your insurance card, please? Wait, why are you here? Oh, we never got the letter from your referring physician. You need a specialist. Oh, I've got to get a down payment and on. This is what drives Americans crazy. So we hope that this information technology boost will really help us make better decisions. Certainly will help us to be safer. That's very important. And lastly, prevention and wellness, thank goodness, a lot more money, $3 billion going to the Center for Disease Control. And the president talked about it, even though it's only $150 million, he'd like to figure out how to reduce HAI hospital-acquired infection. Translation, something we gave you when you came in that you didn't have. A bad thing. Pennsylvania is a leader in understanding and reducing hospital-acquired infections with the first ever hospital-specific report in 2006. So I hope by now you're beginning to understand this doesn't lend itself to a quick political conversation. We're talking about our national identity, our national culture. We're talking about changing behavior. We're talking about making better decisions. We're talking about improving processes. We're talking about reducing medical error. That takes leadership in a different format than what our current system is set up to do. Even with the president's leadership, even with the power of the office and the bully pulpit last night, it was really a great speech, but it really wasn't a great policy analysis of what the real problems are and how we're going to face them. And to me, I think that's a disappointment, and I hope you'll have a deeper understanding. Okay, so let's turn to the future, and one of my favorite little books, I hope you've read Malcolm Gladwell's first book called The Tipping Point. Here's the question at 10 of 8. Are we at the tipping point finally? You know, the president's forceful conclusion with the Kennedy clan sitting there, Vicky's eyes tearing up, his two oldest sons sitting in the audience. It was a powerful American political theater. And he said, many have failed, but on my watch, we're going to make it happen. Putting all of his personal power and all of his IOUs behind getting this done in the first term with the goal of then implementing it in the second term. So here's the question. Are we at the tipping point? Well, you know, I don't know the answer. I'm going to be interested to hear your views when we have time. So let me give you a little sense of where I think we're going in the future. So to talk about the future, these are my twin 22-year-olds. This is Rachel. This is Leah. This is 18-year-old Jake. You get the idea. Rachel, Leah, Jake, David, married to Esther. We're all out of Old Testament names at this point. I'm incredibly proud of these three, and I just use this as my jumping-off point to sort of talk about where we're going. What kind of healthcare world will they inherit? That's a key question. Something that concerns my wife and me greatly, and ought to concern all the parents in this room. So, here's a couple of things we have to think about. This is the real answer, the real leadership it's going to take, and it's a tough, tough challenge. We're going to need to replace the pernicious piecework payment system. If you tell doctors we're going to pay you to do piecework, what will we do? Become outstanding pieceworkers. There are 18,000 CPT billing codes. Zero for coordinating care. Zero. So if you come to us, what are we going to do? Line up those codes, we'll make your head spin. We spend millions on experts to help us reap the benefit of improving our coding. That's where a lot of energy goes. Number two, realign incentives. Well, if you pay us to do piecework, we'll do piecework. If you pay us to work as a team, well, we'll try. We'll try, because we're human like everybody else. If you pay us to work as a team, you better teach us how to be a team. Well, for that, you're going to need some extra education. Number three, create rewards for collaboration, coordination, and conservative practice. And number four, oh boy, recognize the cultural barriers, a topic for another time. So this is pretty powerful. These are big hurdles. There's more. What are the other cultural barriers? Well, what I've called slavish adherence to professional autonomy. That's a fancy way of saying, ladies and gentlemen, we're really good at what we do. After all, that's why you came to Jefferson. Our waiting room is crowded. It'll take you 3 months to get an appointment. Those are our measures of success. And as some faculty have said to my face in my 19-year tenure at Jefferson, David, here we write the guidelines, we don't necessarily have to follow them. That's the culture. That's the culture of practice. It's scary. Powerful. Imagine the President of the United States explaining the medical culture. Where would he start? Yikes. So, a lack of evidence basis, since we only have information that helps us get it right 1 out of 5 times. An atavistic training paradigm. Wow, that's a couple of 3 SAT words right in a row. That means we've got to change the model. And that's what our School of Population Health, contiguous with Jefferson Medical College, is all about. Because if you're going to be a leader, you're not going to get the leadership training in medical school. That's for darn sure. It's too much information. To become a leader, you're going to need an extra ticket, extra exposure to the work of what it means to be a team. Can we train people to do a better job, coordinate, work together, share information, admit mistakes, understand a process? These are powerful things. And Jefferson is a fantastic school, one of the best. And yet, we have tremendous challenges that lie ahead, as articulated here. Leadership and teamwork training, and then, of course, our culture now, negative status for primary care. The average Jefferson Medical College student who graduated in June of this past summer, she came out on average, $185,000 in debt. That's a mortgage. Now, to say to them, well, go and be a primary care doctor, where in Philadelphia, you'll have a starting salary of $115,000, already $180,000 in debt. But if you go do a dermatology training program, your starting salary will be 4 times that. You see how difficult this becomes. In most countries that have been able to control healthcare costs, the ratio of primary care doctors to specialists is exactly reverse of ours. So this is the leadership to overcome cultural barriers. Let me tell you about one handy little book that our whole school is reading. George Halverson is the president of Kaiser Permanente in California. Perhaps you've heard of it. Detail's not important. But what is important is the following. Let me get right to it. Here's what I think our current approach is and where we need to go. Well, let's focus on this list because it's a daunting list that really will require a different kind of leadership than we currently have. Let's start here. So focus on current medical problem. Well, that's certainly what we train for. How about doing a risk appraisal and giving me a risk score of what I will need to do to reduce my future expenditures and what behavior change I'll need? That's complicated but doable. Primary care doctors, you know, how about a cooperative team of providers, nurse practitioners, and others who, with research evidence to support it, do as good a job on lots of primary care issues at a much lower price. Boy, those are fighting words on a medical school campus. That could be a real challenge. How about number three? Care based on the periodic visit. Come in when you're sick. How about continuous healing relationship? Every 50,000 miles, you want to get that car looked at. My Ford dealer does a much better job of this than my own primary care doctor, for me. And I'm sure you have a similar experience. How about short visits with little information? If you saw our schedule in our primary care office, every 10 minutes.
And of course that can work, but when we're paid by the visit, paid to do piecework, that is the normal reaction.
We've got to go to an emphasis on education and coaching. Involve the patient, patient-centered care. Decisions by clinical autonomy, this is the way we do it here. Well, that's lovely. In God we trust. All others publish their outcomes daily.
That's what you want to ask your doctor. How many times have you done this, and what are your outcomes been? And if she is uncomfortable with your question, my advice is go elsewhere. Very important component.
How about one size fits all, care customized to needs and values, and the patient as a passive participant, like my mother, who judges quality on a few key characteristics. Was the waiting room crowded? Was he cute? She's 80. Was he nice to me? Which that could be a problem. And when I left, did the nurse hold my hand and help me write the check? That's Charlotte Nash's quality criteria. No. And about what most Medicare recipients, on average, with the research evidence to support it, that's how they view care. What you will be about, everybody here at Dickinson in school, you're going to be a totally different generation, just like my children. You're going to go online, you're going to become an expert, you're going to go in armed for bear, asking incredibly complicated, tough questions. You're going to Google everything, and you're going to say, gee, at the Mayo Clinic, they do this procedure for one-third of the price you want. How come? And they have better outcomes. I don't get it. Why should I come here? That is what you're going to be about. I hope so, because that's what's going to ultimately fix this mess. So you see, then, how our current approach and how different our current approach is from where we have to go. Let me turn then to the third and final part of our time together, and I'm going to cut this short by in half and just give you my special advertisement for the Jefferson School of Population Health. And in so doing, here's what I'd like to accomplish. I'd like to show you in 5 minutes why we believe on our campus, contiguous with the nation's largest private medical school, why we believe our school is going to be a part of the solution to this mess and not a part of the ongoing problem. Maybe some of you remember, looking around the room, a handful. You remember the 1969 height of the Vietnam War bumper sticker? I had one on my loose leaf in junior high. It said this: if you're not a part of the solution, you're automatically a part of the problem. That's a long time ago, I admit. But 40 years later, it's still true. Still true. So let me tell you a little bit about what we're hoping to accomplish since yesterday, 9909, was the very first day of school. I'm so glad that I have two of my key colleagues in the audience to be supportive. So first of all, what the heck is population health? Well, it's a little broader than public health because it recognizes not only morbidity and mortality and quality of life, but things like socioeconomic status, the processes of medical care, the environment, our social status, demography, all of the above. A much broader term than public health. We can attribute population health to the work of David Kindig and others of 3 decades ago at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, among others. But our mission is as follows: to prepare leaders, the Leadership Forum, with global vision, who will develop and implement policies and systems, public health and population health, that improve the health of the population and enhance the quality of life. Well, that's a pretty broad and important statement. How are we going to do that? Well, we're going to do it currently in 3 ways. And here are the models representing our 3 current programs. Let's start with our central and most important one to start is our master's program in public health, a fully accredited 7-year grade A from the accrediting agency program, a very traditional generalist education in public health, flanked on either side by 2 brand new programs, our program in health policy and our 2nd in the country master's degree program in healthcare quality and safety. I'm very happy to tell you that yesterday over 115 adults enrolled in our school and are taking at least one or two graduate level courses across these three programs. All of our courses currently are at night, so all of the students are working individuals generally who are working all day, some in healthcare, many not, and coming onto our campus to earn one of these three programs. We are the home for a major national journal called Population Health Management that comes from an important organization in Washington, D.C. called DMAA. And let me leave you with a couple of closing thoughts, and then I'm happy to take questions. So let's summarize where we were in the last 55 minutes. Part one, we're in a jam. It's too complicated for 15 seconds on Meet the Press. The issues are troubling at a very deep cultural level, not to mention the economic mess, too. Part two, there's hope. If we can get people to eat right, wear a seatbelt, think about prevention, stop smoking, we can bend that cost curve, use that savings to fund coverage for the uninsured. In the words of late Senator Kennedy, a moral and ethical challenge for our country. Part three, well, there are some cultural challenges that we're going to need to tackle that will require real leadership, total transformation in our thinking about this problem, moving from health insurance reform to real health reform. And then finally, maybe one teeny part of the answer is schools like ours to train a different kind of leader interested in the population. So my favorite president said it best, I think. LBJ, you know, ancient history for most folks here now. It's always better to have them in the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in. Translation, keep your friends close and your enemies closer. The president of the United States is a genius at doing this, and what you saw last night was incredible. American political theater at its ultimate. But the real test of leadership is going to be, can he make the difference? Can he use that power that he possesses working with Congress to put forth legislation that will fundamentally alter the challenges, the crazy system that only uniquely American we have created since the Second World War? It's an incredibly important leadership question for the future, and all of us have to be a part of the conversation. So let me leave you with my final slide. I want to once again thank Professor Pullman, Professor Sarcone, Provost Weissman, all of you, especially, of course, Dr. and Mrs. Grandin for coming out this evening. From my perspective, folks, you know, every day what helps me get out of bed is to recognize this is a major national emergency. We have got to get this right. Whatever your politics is largely irrelevant, because you can't fix what's broke in our country without paying attention to all the issues we talked about here this evening. Thank you very much for coming. Regrettably, the United States isn't in the top third of all developed nations in the world by any societal measure of health. We're not in the top 30. We spend the most, and you have to really ask yourself the question, what are we getting for the money we're spending? And you'll note that I did not delve into the international comparison question because it is so depressing. But if you look overseas in the developed world, Britain, France, Germany, Australia, elsewhere, all of their outcomes by whatever measure you'd like, World Health Organization, OECD, others, International Society for Quality and Evaluation, we're not in the top 30 by any of the current available measures. But, let me move over here, our national identity, that rugged individualism, that I want the MRI tomorrow and I don't care what it costs, that's costing us a lot. And what we're getting for that, well, I'll leave that to you to decide. But by every measure possible, we're not even in the top 30. It's a very, very disheartening issue. Great question. Other questions? Yes, sir. Just wait for them to bring me the microphone, please.
Richard Slade, Planet Earth. How can you hope to reform a culture when huge corporations and enormous amounts of money are invested driving in exactly the opposite direction? A lot of companies are making lots of money on high fructose corn syrup, and McDonald's is in the Dow. But 50 years ago, hardly anyone ate McDonald's hamburgers.
Right. Yes, great question. So again, for our recording purposes, let me translate. Well, we're up against a huge cultural barrier, maybe even a gigantic boulder we're rolling uphill. And tonight's not the appropriate venue to talk about the omnivore dilemma, among other issues. But you're right. We're facing, how do we change behavior given that these issues are woven into the very fabric of day-to-day life in our country? That's why it's so hard to address it. And I think we need to just change the whole conversation to begin to tackle those kinds of questions. Maybe it's high fructose corn syrup, so that's a piece of it, but I think there are so many more fundamental issues. How about we just start with, we need some personal responsibility. We need a two-way street here. If you want accountability, like the president said last night, one of his principal goals is to make health insurance companies accountable. Well, what exactly does that mean? And what would that do without our being accountable as well? So part of your challenge is, don't eat anything your grandmother couldn't make, right? And she certainly didn't have McDonald's. So the challenge is very complicated. This is going to take cultural shift, which is why you see the kind of leadership that we have currently tackling. It's an excellent question, no easy answer. I would just summarize by saying that's a part. The high fructose corn syrup is a broader part of the cultural issues that we're tackling. Yeah, tremendous. Incredibly hard. Other questions? Yes, sir. Thank you for the microphone. Thank you.
A year-old think I'm a retired Dickinson professor. I actually have a follow-up to the question the gentleman just asked. And that is, I'd like to hear your views. This movement would be tremendous. If we could move 3% to 8%,
I would do it.
As you said, to what degree would you feel that our pharmaceutical companies, with their constant badging of ads to get us to run to the doctor and ask for specific medication and so on, and then we think we can swallow a pill, and we don't need to exercise, and we don't need to have a good diet. To what degree are they to blame for this problem?
Yeah, so let me paraphrase again now. To what extent can we blame the pharmaceutical industry for the jam we're in? That's a very interesting question, which can certainly take an hour. Let me give you a quick summary. All the evidence points to the fact that drug costs, taken as a whole, what percent of the whole problem can we attribute the total cost of care to drugs? The answer is 8%. So, where's the money? The money is really not in vilifying the insurance industry or vilifying the pharmaceutical industry. It feels good because they're an obvious target. But the real money is in rolling the cultural ball up the hill. It's not the 8%, it's the 80% of Medicare money spent in the last 5 months of life. I didn't put this in the formal comments, but let me tack it on to your excellent question. So, Sarah Palin and the death squads. You know, what an embarrassment. Silliness. But it taps into the fundamental American culture, which is the rugged individualism. You will not tell me what care grandpa will get. The reality is, no other nation on earth does to grandpa what we do. Meaning, come with me tomorrow to any intensive care unit in any community hospital in our nation, and I'll show you what we're doing to grandpa. It's a national shame. That's the real issue. Can the president get up and say what I just said? No. So, is it a death squad? Well, I would never call it that, of course, but we've got to have a national conversation on, at 91, in renal failure, should we dialyze grandpa? Well, if you're not paying for it, what the hell? We can't continue to do that. And that is going to take a difficult ethical conversation in our country, which I believe currently we're not prepared to have. That's an excellent question. One more question. Yes, ma'am. Just wait for the microphone.
Hi, Molly Talley. I'm a Dickens alumna at the Parent Family. My question is, what about the physician community? What about this piecemeal provision and billing and payment system that we have? Who's going to lead that change?
Yeah, great question. Let me repeat the question and paraphrase. So who's going to lead the physician cultural change to move from the piecemeal payment to pay for performance? Let me give you a two-part answer. Okay. So on one hand, I hope our school will help train the clinician of the future who will lead the charge to be more accountable, to be transparent, and to be willing to be paid based on effort. That's one answer. The other piece is, I don't see the current physician community taken as a whole, in general, on average, as supportive of that move. For all kinds of reasons, some good, some less good, but, you know, generally speaking, doctors, in part by training, are conservative lot. That's what we're about. We don't want to rush to a decision. We're taught to be that way. And so we don't really want a lot of change in the status quo. Sure, we'd like to see the uninsured be covered, but changing the fundamental culture of what we're about is going to mean changing the training paradigm. Until we do that, here's the analogy. To some extent, American medical education, temples of technology, envy of the world, we're building a Hugo for a marketplace that wants a front wheel drive, 15 airbag, 90 miles per gallon Prius. And until we recognize that the factory floor has to be changed to build a different kind of doctor for the future, it's going to be very difficult. The current culture is not going to be swayed by these arguments. That's a complex answer I gave you, but it's an incredibly important challenge. Incredibly. Ladies and gentlemen, let me say once again, thank you for coming. Have a great night. Appreciate it.